So today's guest is Alex Bates. He's a good friend of mine. I've known him for several years. I met him through EO, Entrepreneurs Organization, and he actually lives in the building next door to me in San Diego. So we've had a lot of really good scotch nights together. And nice. I'm really happy to have you on today. How are you doing, Alex?
Doing great, and great to be on with both of you here today.
Perfect. So tell us a little bit about your company. What did it do, and how did you start it?
Yeah, well, you know, the early origins of the company came out of some consulting experience we had, and it's now kind of called the IoT, Internet of Things. And I met my co-founder just on a camping outing socially, just kind of randomly, and we had a lot of common interests, and we were doing consulting. His background was mechanical engineering and sort of maintenance of big industrial equipment. My background was, you know, computer science and kind of neural networks and AI. And we started talking about ways we could, you know, use new technology in this field. And out of our consulting practice, we decided to bootstrap this company and actually, you know, fund some software development and work on getting things going. And really from the beginning, it was we knew there had to be a better way. These big industrial energy companies were doing maintenance on a calendar schedule and having tons of equipment breakdowns. And sometimes you had big environmental catastrophes. And meanwhile, all this data was getting collected. We knew there was a better technology approach to doing maintenance and preventing these environmental catastrophes. So we really just started working on different technologies that could fit in that. And over time, we crystallized a vision of creating a world that doesn't break down. And that became kind of our why statement of the company. And we also came up with a mission of protecting all the world's critical assets within 5 years. By the time we refined that, that was our target goal. But so it was really using AI and machine learning to, you know, to learn to monitor this industrial equipment, learn how to predict failure, and how to prevent these catastrophes that we saw with things like the Gulf oil spill.
Wow, that is sounds like pretty heady stuff in terms of, you know, industrial monitoring and predicting failure. How did you, I mean, is that something that you're studied in or background, or you just were doing this consulting work and learning about that?
You know, it's interesting. I had almost no experience in the industrial realm. I back when I lived in Oregon, I had dabbled at a company that did industrial control systems, but I was very new to that. My co-founder, on the other hand, was all in on industrial and maintenance. So it was kind of merging those two worlds together of technology and the industrial mechanical engineering and reliability.
You know, there's a lot of companies that are doing consulting or service-based work, and they'd love to get into being a software company. You know, I've talked to a lot of people in that place. How did you manage that transition from, hey, we need to do the consulting work, to also then building software, you know, while you're doing that?
It's a pretty rocky transition, but I think on the other hand, when you're consulting and you're deep in the trenches with customers, it's one of the best ways to really get a finger on the pulse of what their challenges are and how you can really help them, you know, kind of boots on the ground. So the challenging part is that you're completely ripping apart your business model and in fact trying to use one business to fund another one, and there's a lot of trade-offs there. But, you know, we kind of decided that the consulting was a completely temporary thing just to fund our formation of the software company. And so we treated it that way, but still tried to give the white glove treatment to our customers. And some of those consulting customers turned into pilot customers for the software. So that was a natural way to sort of bootstrap the technology and get some customer references. So, I mean, I would recommend it, but also I'd, you know, caution that be aware it can be a rocky transition.
What was something that was rocky in that transition for you?
Well, I mean, part of it is just, you know, you're trying to do a lot of billable hours, and then you're trying to do a lot of R&D. And, you know, there's only so many hours per week. So I think it's what happens with, we had some big consulting clients, like Fortune 500 companies. And if you let them, they'll kind of suck the life out of you. So you have to kind of be careful to, you know, preserve some of your own time and space for your own R&D and not get too deeply entrenched in their or in their organizational structures. I mean, we had clients that would go so far as to invite us out for some of their, you know, employee events, and we just had to sort of pull back to make sure we weren't too all in on the consulting side.
Right. And you talked a little bit about bootstrapping this through your consulting work to build the software. Did you use any other ways to fund the startup and invest in the software development?
It was really a bootstrapping model. I mean, we did have some people come in, advisors, that we had a couple employees move on for just, you know, kind of life transition reasons. And we did have a couple advisors buy out their shares, sort of as smallish, you know, angel investments. But it really was a bootstrap model until we raised a corporate venture round, 2.5 years ago.
So you raised around 2.5 years ago. What did you raise the money for?
Yeah, and you know, so really, it was 8 years into the company, right? So it was early years of bootstrapping, and then we started getting our revenue from the software and so on. But the venture fund that we rounded at the time, we really wanted it to build out a marketing and sales capacity, and also to build up, scale up our infrastructure to support an evolution to cloud and more of a subscription model.
Good. And what fund did you bring in?
Yeah. In terms of the investor, you mean?
Yeah. Who was the investor?
Well, we did everything from talking to institutional investors up in Silicon Valley to talking to strategic corporate investors. And we ended up going with a strategic corporate venture investment from a company called PTC. And the nice thing about that, of course, the terms were probably much more favorable to the entrepreneur than you'd get from an institutional VC, where it's much more of a financial transaction and they're going to put in clauses, you know, to protect their financial interests. And I think a corporate strategic investment, they're more interested in having strategic access to the technology and, you know, the ability to maybe influence the board seat, the direction of the company, and also the chance to adopt it within their company and push it out to their customer base. So we did go with a corporate venture investment for that initial round.
And so it sounds like that was a good experience. And then you also, you know, I imagine were able to do some of the scale up, you know, was it mission accomplished?
Yeah. I mean, it definitely funded, some hiring. We were pretty conservative with it, but it was sort of in between a seed. It was kind of like a Series A, but, you know, maybe a smaller Series A round. But I think it definitely helped us fund towards some of our goals. But we didn't really ramp up massive spending. We were still pretty conservative with the burn rate.
That's great. So it sounds like everything was, you know, moving along. You were growing the company. You raised money. Why did you decide, kind of when and why did you decide to sell?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I mean, I think like a lot of entrepreneurs, we were pretty passionate about the technology and the cause and the mission to a delusional point. But so the selling was almost a secondary consideration. I think we all felt that in our industry in particular, that the way to get our technology to a broad market adoption and to hit our sort of vision of protecting all the world's critical assets, that it was unlikely to have a direct path for us to do that ourselves, like going all the way to an IPO and sort of just scaling our company all the way end to end. So we did feel that probably the likely outcome would be, you know, an M&A event with one of the bigger industrial companies in this space. And industrial is interesting because there was a relative short list of possible acquirers. You know, there's a lot of big names that are pretty well known. We figured that would happen, but at the same time, I think we were all pretty passionate about what we were doing and the impact we could have and just scaling it up. But we felt that when the right partner came along, that we would certainly go that route.
Can you tell me, you know, where were you when that you kind of realized that you guys made that decision to sell? Like, what were you in a room? Was it a meeting? Like, when did you kind of say, hey, we're going to do this?
Yeah, well, we'd had a number of conversations over the years with some of the big industrial Goliaths, everyone from like IBM and GE to other, you know, other companies in that space. So, there were conversations being had. I would say that, you know, around the time that we took that investment, we also happened to meet this boutique investment banking firm and start conversations with them. And I think they helped educate us on how that process worked. And if we were looking at that, how to set ourselves up for doing it. And also, of course, we saw that they were able to broker negotiations and how that whole thing would work out.
Who else did you bring on besides that boutique investment firm?
Well, we also had some additions to our advisory board. We had one key person, Michael Thiemann. He joined probably about 3 years ago, and he came in through a personal, personal contact, and he was an amazing addition. He was part of the HNC software, one of the biggest kind of AI success stories, where they were, they IPO'd, they were acquired for close to $1 billion by FICO, and now they monitor almost all worldwide credit card, transactions for fraud. They were actually based in San Diego, and that's part of why we have this analytics footprint in our city. So he joined ended up joining our advisory board and eventually our board of directors, and he was also extremely helpful to help just, set up the company for success.
Wow, that's really cool. So you've got, this team, you've decided you're ready to sell and you're ready to move on. What did you learn from the investment banker and working with them?
Yeah, they were, so that firm was called, I believe they now are owned by another financial firm, but they were just extremely knowledgeable about the whole process, but also they were pretty specialized in the industrial software space. So they had particular knowledge about, how it works in that particular environment. They told us everything from, here's what a due diligence checklist will look like. We did have a financial acting CFO who had joined our company, and he had made sure our books were pretty clean. But definitely the Pacific Crest took it to the next level as far as making sure, we're setting ourselves up for a path where if it does come together, we're gonna be really well positioned.
Yeah. So, and then you had all that. Did you kind of go to market at that point, or kind of determine a number that you want to sell for and go to market, or what was kind of the next steps after that?
Well, we didn't really have an exact number. I think that we knew that, if we were hitting the milestones we laid out in terms of, growth and closing some marquee customers, that the momentum itself would increase the numbers. They would go and try to find comps, for valuations and so on. But number one, a lot of those transactions were private, and so they weren't publicly disclosed. In some cases, they were able to get, maybe inside information about, okay, we think this was probably the multiple. And just, through the grapevine, figure out what the going rate was. We were also in this emerging market. It's at the intersection of IoT and analytics. And because it's a new and emerging market category, there weren't a long list of transactions because it kind of was a new space, if that makes sense.
So, Alex, my experience is that every entrepreneur has their own number. Did you have a number?
Well, I think that anywhere around, I don't know. I think we had tossed around different ideas in terms of multiples. I think that at the time I was happy, early on. It's funny because the number changes over time, right? Like at one point you're like, man, if we go above 20, and then at the next point it's like, man, if we go above 30, and then at the next one it's like, hey, if we're close to 40. So I think the number kind of evolved also with our growth. But when we finally consummated the deal, it was definitely at the number I was very happy with.
Yeah, you just before we jumped on this call, you were saying you're at the tax man, and obviously living in California like we do, it's a painful place. So sometimes you build a number and then you start going, holy crap, after taxes, that's not a lot.
On the one hand, it's a good problem to have. We all used to joke like that's a high class problem, but certainly California is not a cheap state.
So you went out to market and you started to shop. Tell us about that sales process and you know what happened.
Yeah, well, the interesting thing, I think, you know, for companies looking at M&A, when you talk to a savvy investment banker, they'll tell you, you don't want to put out a message that you're up for sale, right? Like that sort of undermines your value. And it also looks a little bit desperate. So there's sort of a process where you can, I mean, at the high end, you can do this outreach where you'll become, there'll be awareness will spread to Wall Street analysts who in then turn inform some of the big players. And then they'll hear about you through back channels where they'll certainly want to reach out and pursue you. And that's a really good model. And so I think for us, you know, we weren't sort of putting out radar pings that were for sale, but we were leveraging these bankers that had, you know, they had back channel conversations and were able to put information in the hands of people that could reach maybe potential target acquirers.
Mm-hmm. And so did you have anybody get interested and start to approach you?
Yeah, well, and what's interesting is it turned out that AspenTech, who was our you know, our eventual acquirer, they had become aware of us already about 2 years before the actual acquisition. But really, it was 6 months prior where they really flew out a team and really suddenly started taking the interest to the next level. And really, from that point forward, it was really key as far as having our, you know, Pacific Crest to help guide us through that process.
Once they said and they that's, were
interested. You're saying who you...
Oops. Go ahead.
You're saying that you ultimately sold to them, but I think when we talked, you also said that they're, you know, a little, maybe a couple years earlier, when you first went out, you had somebody interested, but you weren't quite maybe getting to the numbers that you wanted. Do you maybe tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah. So there was a conversation almost maybe 3 years prior, and it was with another big industrial company. And yeah, I mean, I think at the time, a couple things happened. We were earlier stage, and the market had hit a little bit of a rough patch. And so, number one, we weren't on an upward trajectory in terms of momentum. So that was one issue. And another issue is just that we, like a lot of startups, had a lot of chaotic internal processes. And so, and maybe if we would have had better processes, we would have still rode out that rough patch in the market and had a stronger, you know, kind of sales pipeline. So that conversation failed to consummate in an acquisition. And it was after that, you know, we did two things. We did raise this corporate round, but we also brought in some external coaching to help us really improve the processes that were pretty broken internally.
Okay, got it. So you were saying that the investment that you took on 2.5 years ago from the corporate, what was in light of kind of not ultimately selling, but taking on some money, is that correct?
Yeah. So after that, we decided to take a round and then really try to improve our company and make it much stronger, especially looking at operational perspectives and then in our sales process.
Okay, and so you went, and you said you kind of went back and you brought this coach in. Tell us some of the things you did specifically to increase the value and start to make some transitions.
Yeah, well, we knew we had wanted to make this jump to subscription pricing and towards software as a service. And so, but there's a lot of inertia to making changes to pricing catalogs and, of course, existing target prospects in your pipeline want to stick with the existing enterprise pricing. So it is initially a pretty tough transition, but we decided we had to do it. So we started making those changes to, you know, how we can adapt subscription pricing and changing our internal process to support that. So that was one very concrete thing. And the other things involved just looking at what our current process was for quantifying the sales pipeline, all the way from leads to opportunities and the stage gates between them, and you know how we qualify customers, and of course we, like a lot of companies, we had this thing where you chase the shiny ball, you know, hey, we got a new lead, and suddenly you prioritize these new leads as opposed to ones that are actually have a budget and are going to close within 3 months. And they helped, you know, our coaches really helped us refine our whole sales prospecting model. And then operationally looking at even things like customer support and internal process to support that.
A lot of people want to figure out how to go from kind of enterprise to SaaS. Was like, how did that transition go? And what did you learn from that, that you would kind of offer advice, or what would you do in the future?
You know, it's, I think any transition like that can be a little bit rough going. I think that because there is so much inertia to big changes like that, for us, it was helpful to have this external coaching consulting firm. Number one, to sort of diffuse egos when conversations come up about things that are going to change. And two, just to keep you on point, because these are multi-month transitions and you really have to. And meanwhile, you're trying to run your business and make this radical change. So it was helpful for us to have outside help and meeting, you know, regularly to look at, make sure we're on track to make that go. And for us, it was interesting because we did the subscription pricing transition. So that was one aspect. The second aspect can be cloud hosting. And a lot of times SaaS is considered synonymous with you're hosting the software, so customers don't have to have it on premise. But you can actually do subscription pricing and still have an on-premise software model. And in the industrial sector, some clients still, they love subscription pricing, but they're not ready for complete cloud hosting because there's concerns about their control system and getting data up in the cloud. And there's a lot of just, you know, real world challenges there. So we supported both models. So we did full subscription pricing, and we had some cloud hosted customers and some on-prem customers.
So in these changes that you made, like, what was the impact to, like, your value, growth, the focus? You know, how did that kind of impact all of those things?
I would say there's no question it improved the valuation. I mean, our you know, what investment bankers will do is they'll pull up comps, and it was clear that SaaS multiples were higher than enterprise value or enterprise companies. So we knew that was a better model. We also knew that in the industry itself, there was a shift towards SaaS and subscription pricing. So startups really shouldn't be at the lagging end of adopting those changes that are clearly, you know, have a lot of momentum. So we wanted to be at the leading end of that transition. So we just decided to embrace it.
Once you decided to sell, you know, you found the buyer, you got kind of these things sorted out, how long was the process of actually selling from when you first started talking, and how did the process work?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think earnest conversations probably started, you know, maybe 6 months out, and then due diligence was about a 3 month process. So there were initial conversations, and then there's a whole process where there's a letter of intent, a signature, you know, and then a formal due diligence process for going through that. So that was kind of the timeline.
When did you tell your staff, and how did they take it?
Well, see, this is what's interesting about this process. And a lot of this was new to me, but there was a high degree of confidentiality in these discussions that was requested. And so we also, one of the things we learned from the you know, experience 3 years prior was that the most important thing when you start these conversations is not to kind of take your eye off the ball and not to get distracted, but how do you want to start those conversations, but you want to just also keep your foot on the gas pedal of growing your business and, you know, hitting your milestones and that kind of thing. And so if we would have told all of our staff, you know, clearly this would be a major distraction and people kind of get short timer syndrome. So we really didn't tell anyone until pretty close to the end of the process, very close to the end of the process when obviously we had to tell them and get signatures and things like that.
When you say you learned that kind of that, you know, you did it the second time around, did you do something different the first time?
Yeah, I think the first time a lot more people were aware And the problem, of course, is that these things are always very, very tentative. And at best, they take longer than you think. And at worst, you know, you might have conversations that die out and then more conversations that come in. So it could be demotivational if you're always, I think as leaders, you have to modulate a lot of those highs and lows, because it, obviously there's a lot of, can be a lot of stress involved. And I think us as technical and entrepreneurial leaders have to bear that on our shoulders. And then certainly when the good news is official, you share it with everyone. But when there's possible good news, and then sometimes that falls through at the last second, that's more stress than some people can take. So we were careful to sort of shield that.
I remember when we went through our sale, and then subsequently I was part of a company where we bought about 40 companies. Every group kind of shared with their employees in different ways. I mean, sometimes, you know, we would show up and they were like learning about it for the first time, and that didn't go well. And then sometimes, right, you know, sometimes people told them way too early, and then there's this kind of like long-term fear and uncertainty, and that's not healthy either. So it's like, you know, when exactly do you bring them in? You know, is there a moment where you say, man, this is the time where we should bring the employees in?
You know, I think it probably depends a little bit on the situation. Cause like you say, you don't want to wait too long and you don't want to go too early. And that takes, there's a lot of judgment calls there. I mean, once you really maybe feel in your gut that it's 100% sure, you might at that point decide to share, maybe at least with more people on the leadership team. But certainly that's a tough one.
And then just out of curiosity, how many employees did you have? And then how many of them maybe even had any equity or shares?
Well, technically we had 9 full-time employees, but we did have a pool of contractors and some were full-time equivalent, almost like employees. So with that, you know, we had probably about close to 20, including the contractors. And you asked how many shareholders there were?
Yes.
Yeah, well, so
that were employees as well.
They were employees. I mean, all of our employees had stock options. So that Great. Was that was throughout the company. Consultants, only 1 or 2 did. And then our board members also had equity in the company.
Mm-hmm. Kind of during this due diligence process and kind of mid-sale, what was your, did you have like one huge major concern throughout the process?
Well, I think part of our concern was sort of just, you know, where you get a little paranoid that something can go wrong, especially when you've failed to consummate in the past. So I think there's a lot of just maybe paranoia about, oh, you know, we have to, and there's so much paperwork, like you'll get a questionnaire with 100 technical questions and you fill out and answer all 100, and then you get follow-up questions, which are 200 questions. And then you answer those, and then it's like 500 questions. So, and I think part of it is, wow, are we ever going to have time to finish all these questions? And is it going to sort of distract us from growing our business? And then just, you know, of course you worry about, we were trying to close some big deals, and we were actually able to close some deals during due diligence, which also is very helpful from a negotiating perspective. So I think that it was just, it's like, man, are we going to be able to close these deals and answer all their questions and that kind of thing?
So you said you had a little failure to perform in the past. I believe there's a pill for that, right?
You know, yeah, if you could, yeah, I need, might need some information on that.
But you did perform on this one. So you sold, tell me, yeah, how much did you sell for?
Yeah, so they actually decided to publicly disclose that. So it was $37 million, all cash deal, and that was the amount.
Brandon, I think we need a sound effect next time we hear that, because that $37 million, that sounds awesome.
And all cash too.
9 full time employees, all cash. So no earnout, no funny business, just a wire to your bank account.
It was just a wire. And, you know, they always carve out 15% sort of, yep, as a, you know, reps and warranties kind of thing. But, mm-hmm, but yeah, it was a cash deal. So everyone was a big celebration.
So where were you when you heard that it closed and the $37 million minus the 15% was being wired to your bank account?
Well, I'll tell you, I was, as one of the technical leaders of the company, I was intimately involved and engaged, because the final day of due diligence, they had a team that flew out from Boston. And so they wanted to start at 6 a.m. and do this detailed technical screening where they're running code from the compiler, and they're also installing the media and running a battery of tests and making sure everything is 100% identical. It was definitely the most thorough evaluation I've ever been a part of. I mean, the whole due diligence was extremely thorough. We were pretty impressed. But so the final day, of course, is pretty nerve-wracking, and it took 12 hours. It was a 12-hour day. And then, you know, they wanted to have all of these sort of check marks and verifications. And at the end of that, you know, was when the wires came through.
So you're sitting there working all day, working your butt off, probably the most stressful day of your life, making sure all the things are tight. And so then at the end, that all happens and the wire happens. What was the, like, emotion that you felt at that moment when it closed?
You know, it was a combination of elation and just, it's like when you've just run a marathon and you just, like, step over the finish line, and half of you just wants to go take a nap, and the other half's like, no, I got to go out and celebrate. So we did go out, and there was some pretty good scotch involved that night. But yeah, it was just also just a huge sigh of relief, like, because there's a lot of negotiation that happened right up to the 11th hour to make it seem like it could have been tentative. So then it's just like, it happens, and you actually kind of pinch yourself, and you're like, wait, did it happen? And then you're like, wait, show me that again.
did you log into your bank account and see how many zeros were behind the number?
We shared it. Actually, our CFO pulled it up and showed it to me, and he actually took a photo of it. So that was the biggest that account had ever been.
Very cool.
What kind of, after, you know, all the dust settled from that, how has the sale really changed your life?
Oh man, I mean, a lot of different ways. I think, well, first of all, it obviously eliminates a lot of, it gives you a lot more financial independence and freedom, which frees up part of your mind that was maybe caught up in things that are a little bit more distracting. And now obviously it frees some of that up, and then you can start to think about other things. And then you go out, and I think you meet a lot of interesting people that kind of opens up some conversations. And yeah, I mean, I think for me, in this space of AI and analytics, it definitely made it easier to get a hold of people and start talking about future projects and collaborations also.
Who's the most interesting person you met from that?
Well, I would have to say it would definitely be Richard Branson, which was an opportunity that came up to go out, you know, to his island, Necker Island, which I guess is only one of his two private islands. And I mean, that guy is pretty amazing in terms of, I mean, in some similar ways to Elon Musk, because he has a space company, you know, Virgin Galactic. He actually has an underwater company to do sort of these high-end submarines. And then, you know, also he has Virgin. But meanwhile, he lives on these islands in the Caribbean, British Virgin Islands, and has all these people fly out to his island. And that includes, like, you know, high-end scientific and engineer people from, like, Singularity University. And they'll do, like, TED Talks. And then he'll go out kite surfing at 6 a.m. And, I mean, that guy is just, the way he lives his life is amazing. His nurse was there, and she told us stories like he's still out mountain biking down cliffs, and he'll fall and almost knock his teeth through his mouth and get back up and do it again the next week. So it's pretty inspiring. This guy's in his 60s and he's still living his life like that.
Very cool. So when are we going to be able to visit Bates Island?
Well, I'm taking notes. I mean, man, people like that, it helps you think about, wow, what would be the next level? Also, Elon Musk, I mean, a guy that decided to disrupt, you know, multiple $10 to $100 billion industries just for fun. I mean, that's interesting to think about those kinds of things. So I'll keep you posted, but I probably won't be opening a Bates Motel. Yeah, I think that would
that'd be bad marketing.
If you didn't buy an island, what's kind of one thing that you bought or a couple things that you bought?
Yeah, well, so I did finally get a house, and so I'm moving out of a downtown condo into a house, and that's been a pretty nice transition, because you leave your condo, but then you get the backyard and that, so that's been fun to get that all settled in. And then also, I did finally, on the Elon Musk talking about that, I did get a Tesla Model S P100D, which is it's a pretty It's just an amazing piece of engineering, and I will admit I almost gave myself whiplash. So, kind of learning how to dial back on the throttle.
And that's not a splurge. I think any self-respecting CTO has to have a Tesla.
Yeah, good point. Requirement.
What are you doing now? You had to stay on with the company, right? How long do you need to stay on, and kind of what are you working on now?
Yeah, well, the initial discussion was for, this a 2-year process, and possibly farther, but there were some retention things involved, so I did agree to stay on as a full-time employee, as did my co-founder Paul, so and some other like most of our personnel stayed on, so I think everyone got offers for employment. So yeah, I mean, at this point, it's been interesting to see. I would say that AspenTech is very experienced. They've, in their history, have acquired over 30 companies, so they have a pretty detailed playbook. And a lot of the work now is, number one, on the integration side, tying everything into this bigger organization with a bigger sales force, customer support, R&D, and meeting with a lot more people for those different areas. And then, a little bit of evangelism. So, I do a little bit of talking here and there, but not a massive amount. But yeah, so I think it's just now helping through their organization try to deliver on that original vision of creating a world that doesn't break down, which was a complementary vision to theirs. So, I think it's just helping them through that.
Tell me, is it different being an employee than an owner? Like, how has that changed for you in your life?
It is radically different. That's probably
That's my
the roughest
understatement.
adjustment. Oh man, I mean, you're a technical entrepreneur. You call the shots, and you have a budget, as small as it might be. You at least control the budget, and now you're an influencer,
Right.
and so that's a radical shift. We'll have to get used to that part, but it is nice having the extra resources. So you try to take the good with the bad.
And an OPM is always good. Other people's money.
OPM, very
Have
very happy with that.
you learned anything kind of how you were operating your company and then going and working for such a larger company that's acquired all these companies, is in how they do business and how you used to do business? Is there any like key takeaways of things you've learned?
Wow, yeah. I mean, I've actually learned a lot from the technical leaders in this organization. In fact, we thought there was a really great culture fit from the very beginning of our conversations. Just really incredibly smart. This team is grown out of these engineers out of MIT that spun the company out like 35 years ago. They're all really humble, really hardworking, very technically shrewd and savvy, and great people to work with. So I actually have learned still more technical information. I learned about chemical engineering, which I actually never would have thought I would be learning about. Those their roots, and yeah, just the way they run it, their processes, I think has been helpful. On our side, I think we've helped them. They wanted to embrace more agile processes, and we've helped them on that journey where they had more sort of waterfall style software development. So now we're helping them move towards more Scrum Agile, and kind of finding a happy middle ground. But yeah, certainly I've learned quite a bit.
So from, the starting of your company, from consulting to building software, from software, enterprise to SaaS to selling, I mean, you've gone through a ton of stuff and then joining this company. How will your next project be different if you were to start a new one from, from what you've done in the past?
It's interesting. I always think, like, what would my lessons learned be? But there's so many. I think you make so many mistakes. And the hardest thing to really quantify, but yet the most important, is knowing what to prioritize, what's really important at a given stage of your company's evolution. And I think we made a lot of classic mistakes about over prioritizing, you know, maybe marketing and marcom at certain points in time, and then over prioritizing or under prioritizing sales at other points in time, and things like customer support, making sure you don't drop existing customers just when you're pursuing new customers, just knowing all those trade-offs. Every startup is spread extremely thin. So I think a lot of the instinctual things about knowing how to prioritize and also how to shift the priorities when you do that. And another practical thing is bringing in outside consultant coaches. You do have to be careful because there's tons of consultants that will come in and bill hours, you know, as long as they can. But we found some really solid ones that were helped to sort of do external sprints with our senior leadership team and make sure we stayed on track for some of those initiatives.
And what was the best resource that somebody can go and look at or grab when it comes to dealing with this issue of prioritization that you said you learned a lot about?
Well, it's a question I've seen, you know, the scaling up Rockefeller Habits model. I actually learned about that through EO. That in general helps you understand a lot of the principles to improve your core processes, whether it's people or infrastructure and procedures. But we also worked with a company called RevCult, which sort of implemented. Habits can be overwhelming. It's an extremely thorough book and process. So probably just find coaches to help step through that. At least for the way we operated, that was helpful to help people kind of walk us through that journey.
You hear so many bad things about consultants and coaches. Do you have any advice on kind of how to pick the right people?
That, you know, that is tough because we actually had, you know, on our evolution, we certainly early on picked coaches where we thought, wow, this is the guy we need to work with. And turned out maybe they're prioritizing the wrong thing. So it's really tough. I mean, you can check their track record, check their references. But for me, if they're grounded in once we read that book, tried to just, it was such a massive sea change that it was so hard to get momentum, especially to get other people on the leadership team to go all in on it when they felt like I was kind of, you know, forcing it upon them. But once we found this external coach who was clearly, you know, I had read the book, so I asked him lots of questions like about scaling up. And not only had he read it, he had clearly coached companies through it. And so that was a helpful kind of thing to test out.
So it was with the entrepreneurs who are listening, and you know, what's the one piece of advice that you'd give to them if they're starting to think about selling their company?
Yeah, one piece of advice, which is a little bit kind of turns the question a little, is I think, you know, focus on your vision and your why and your mission statement, and that's going to get you through the lows. I think that, you know, acquisitions usually take longer than you think. And if you, it's one of those counterintuitive things where if you just, it's probably a natural, I mean, every entrepreneur, you make a lot of sacrifices, you forego a lot of income, and clearly you would want some kind of liquidity event to pay you back for all that. Otherwise, you know, kind of, it would just be a rough road to take. So, for sure, you know, that's going to be a natural thing you want to go towards. But I would say if you really focus on what your vision is and also set proof points, you know, here's our milestones, here's what we're out to do, and just go all in on that. But I would advise, even though you want to focus on building your business, maybe have a conversation with an investment banker. Just in the back of your mind, you'll start to know about what processes they look for in due diligence. And you start to know, wow, we better get our Salesforce pipeline totally dialed in. We better get our customer support processes documented. We better get, you know, our product management dialed in with a detailed roadmap. So I think starting those conversations will help you, even if you also decide to grow in your business as well.
That's really good advice. I appreciate it. I've got a few kind of personal questions for you. How old are you?
I just had a rough transition on that one. Just crossed the big 40 number. So,
Wow.
happy birthday.
thank you.
And did you go to college?
Yeah, I did. I went up to University of Oregon, and that was a great university, rainy climate. There was a little sort of honors college program there, but I grew up mostly in Oregon, so I went to school, kind of in state, and kind of double majored in math and computer science. But I was really interested in AI, so I took like I think 64 credits of neuroscience, which wasn't even didn't count towards a major. So I was kind of not really sure how that helped, but I think it was just a passion.
Someday you and I will have to share some University of Oregon experiences
We definitely
stories.
should. Oh man.
And what is your relationship status?
Oh yeah, I mean, I am actually I'm single as far as relationships go.
What's your Tinder handle for all the ladies?
Yeah, don't I'm not. In spite of being a technologist, I don't necessarily have all those technical apps and Tinder and so on,
Is
but
that what it's
I'll let
called,
you
a
know if I'm
technical
dating.
app?
How
Technology of dating.
can girls or anybody else listening stay in touch with you and kind of follow you on your journey?
Yeah, I don't really have a Twitter or anything like that. I mean, I'm on LinkedIn, I'm on Facebook and so on, but yeah, I don't really keep a blog, so probably LinkedIn on the professional front would be the best way to get a hold of me. I'm always interested in talking about AI or the future of technology and anything like that.
Perfect, Alex. I really